from deep inside your radio. It's freezing here, isn't it? Oh, you wouldn't know. It's London, England, ladies and gentlemen, and it is. I always wondered why my significant other would opine that winter started in mid-November when I would point to the calendar and say, look, honey, see. But now I understand, because it's freezing here. Anyway, it's warm and comfy in the British Le Chaux Dome, and right next door, through the double pane of glass, for my protection, the DJ in the next studio, doing his own show, his own broke thing, is watching the New York Knicks on his computer. Yeah, while he's on the air. Sure, why should he be listening to his show? But, you know, he's probably, ladies and gentlemen, the only Brit who watches basketball. It's understandable. He's 6'3", and he's saying to himself, oh, I could do that. But it's a touch of home. And the Knicks, ladies and gentlemen, the Knicks, they're winning. The world really is upside down. Now, some of the big political news this week was made by Mitt Romney, strangely enough. You usually don't make big political news after you lose. But au contraire, with the Mittman, he really should just stay off the phone or stay off secretly recorded conversations, because they don't do him any good. But continuing his penchant for making friends, he told a conference call of his donors this week that the reason he lost was because President Obama promised gifts, in quotes, to certain groups of the electorate, like young people and Latinos. And, you know, there's been the usual amount of hooting and hollering about that, because obviously this was a tip-off that had he been elected president, we could have looked forward in the first year of his administration to 93% of the income gains in the United States economy being captured by the top 1%. Nobody wants that. We'd far prefer to have a year like 2010, when, according to Emmanuel Saez at UC Berkeley, 93% of the income gains in the United States economy were captured by the top 1%. So it's much better to have a Republican who speaks like a Democrat, as opposed to the other thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I have been up so early this morning to go. There's a thing in British media, British broadcasting, where they gather a couple of people, and they, especially on Sunday morning, and the couple of people, it was three in this case, are brought in early Sunday morning to read the papers. They give you a big stack of papers, a forest apiece, because they still publish a lot of newspapers here for some reason. And you go through them and you kind of circle the stories that you think are funny or important or whatever. So there were a couple that I didn't get to mention on the program of the BBC. So one of them was about the discovery of the most distant galaxy. Scientists have used a very arcane and incomprehensible to me system, probably, I think, making use of the Hubble Space Telescope to locate what at this point is the most distant galaxy known to us so far. So distant that they still think Jimmy Savile is a nice guy. That's so distant that they think... I'm not going to do the rest of those jokes. I wasn't going to do them on the BBC. Why should I do them here? And the other story that I thought was worth noting but didn't have time was from the British newspaper, The Sunday Telegraph. Now, you know, if you've been paying attention, what we've been going through in terms of the economy in the last 4 years. And you know, I think if you've been paying attention, how it started. So this would be notable. And of course, this refers to British banks, but it applies equally, I think, to their American brethren. British bank stocks are becoming uninvestable Due to regulatory upheaval, political interference, and opaque accounts, a powerful investors group has warned the Parliament. The Association of British Insurers says institutions are reluctant to invest in Britain's largest financial institutions because of increasing risks and shrinking returns. They're going to deliver a hard-hitting report to the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards on behalf of its members who control £1.5 trillion in assets. They're among the bank's biggest investors. The prospects, they say, of sustainable economic recovery in the UK are to an extent dependent on banks being able to raise the funds necessary to finance the growth of small and medium-sized companies. From the perspective of institutional investors, it's essential that banks should be an investable proposition. What they're arguing against, among other things, is the proposal to split retail banking from casino banking. They say that would be, that would be disturbing. The combination of the two is not viewed by most investors as an inherently broken model, says the statement, without any response by any folks who would disagree. That may be explained by the fact that above the masthead, the thing on the front page of the business section that says business, there's this in the Sunday Telegraph. Backing business and enterprise. So why would they have a contrary opinion? Hello, welcome to the show. Thank God we don't have a press like that. that galaxy, that newly discovered galaxy, is so far away, they only think there's one Kardashian. From Leicester Square in London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
The Pentagon has been warned to stand guard against climate surprises, which could throw off its efforts to secure America's future. An expert report prepared for the intelligence community by the National Academy of Sciences, what do they know, warns that the security establishment is going to have to start planning for natural disasters, sea level rise, drought, epidemics, and other consequences of climate change. Somebody suckered the Pentagon. The Pentagon already ranks climate change as a national security threat, putting U.S. troops in danger around the world and adding fuel to existing conflicts. More than 30 U.S. bases are threatened by sea level rise. It has also identified potential new danger zones, such as sub-Saharan Africa. The military is also working to cut back on its fuel costs in an age of budget austerity by installing solar arrays and wind turbines. Really? But this new report suggests strategic planners are going to have to make sweeping adjustments to their planning to take account of climate change over the next decade and beyond. Planning beyond the next decade. I'm not sure we're capable of that, folks. Current scenarios could be thrown completely askew by climate surprises, says the report. These could be a single catastrophic event, such as a food price shock. Never happened. Or a cascade of reactions that could ultimately put America at risk. It makes sense for the intelligence community to apply a scenario approach in thinking about potentially disruptive events, the report said. What would be the alternative approaches? That's right. It may make sense to consider the security implications of two or three more plausible trends as a way to anticipate risks. Boy, they're going out on a limb, aren't they? The study also recommends a crash course for intelligence analysts on the potential threat posed by sea level rise, drought, food shortages, and other consequences of climate change. It is essential for the intelligence community, to understand adaptation and changes in vulnerability to climate events. Welcome to the party. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. What's happening with those full-body scanners? Last month, you remember the TSA said it was moving nearly half its X-ray scanners from the nation's bigger airports to smaller ones in the name of efficiency, or in the interest of efficiency. Turns out more than 90 of the controversial machines will sit in a Texas warehouse indefinitely. That's what agency officials revealed this week. The TSA says it hopes to someday deploy the warehoused machines, but even that prospect has been thrown into doubt by allegations that the manufacturer, Rapiscan, may have falsified tests of its experimental privacy software designed to eliminate explicit images of passengers' bodies. This is reported by ProPublica. As you may know, the machines cost you and me about $150,000 each, so this is $14 million worth of machines sitting in a warehouse. Maybe they're taking pictures of each other. That'd be nice. Pictures of the machines on privates. I'd say that's an art piece. Just waiting to happen. The X-ray scanner, as you know, faced outcry over both passenger privacy and possible health risks. So the TSA was removing them from L.A., O'Hare, and Kennedy, replacing them with millimeter wave machines, which do not use X-rays. They use radio waves instead and produce a generic cartoon image of passengers' bodies. I hear those are popular on Fox. The problem with moving the machines to the smaller airports, the TSA found, is that to protect passenger privacy, the TSA requires screeners to review the images in a private room, which has been slowing down lines. The problem, smaller airports lack the space to provide a separate image viewing room. They've discovered that now, you see. kind of grasping what the concept of a smaller airport might in fact mean. The TSA had hoped that this new privacy software would pass tests in time to obviate the need for the private room. But John Sanders of TSA testified this week that that ain't going to happen. This is because of the testing of the backscatter privacy software suddenly failed, said Representative Mike Rogers of Alabama, the chairman of the House Transportation Security Subcommittee. The manufacturer, he says, may have attempted to defraud the government by knowingly manipulating a test to have a successful outcome. That was reported by Bloomberg News. Rapiscan disputes any wrongdoing. They won't take a lie detector test, but they will put one of their spokespeople through their X-ray machine. No, I just said that. The TSA spokesperson at the hearing said, I wouldn't say we have any evidence that documents that they absolutely did manipulate tests. We have information. We've contacted the manufacturer to ask for additional information. And that's all they could say. So right now, ladies and gentlemen, you're safe. Smaller airports are safe. But I'd be worried about danger to that warehouse in Texas. Hey, you got to care about them all. News of the godly. The Australian Catholic Church holds thousands of pages of documents containing the psychosexual profiles of dozens of clergy people accused of sexually abusing children and vulnerable adults. The profiles were often sent to bishops. Hey, they don't watch TV. They were created as part of the church's little-known rehabilitation program for those it described as, quote, sexual boundary violators. Unquote. This was in the years 1997 through 2008. None of the clergy treated under the program was referred to police because of the thing. This is despite senior church figures being aware of serious abuse allegations or in some cases admissions that led to clergy being sent for treatment in the program. In New South Wales, police spokeswoman said although police had received some abuse information from the church, it could not find any record showing referrals out of this special program. Church leaders in Melbourne had not reported any abuse cases to police. Clergy were quietly transitioned out of the church, receiving generous payouts, accommodation, and university education. There were some outrageous situations that would have become very embarrassing for the church had they become public, a well-placed source said. Deals were cut. The whole operation was extremely confidential. Putting the con in confidential. A former Marist brother, who in 2002 admitted to church leaders that he had sexually abused 8 primary school boys in the 70s, was sent to the program for 6 months treatment. Many of the victims, according to court testimony, turned to drugs and alcohol, one dying of a drug overdose. After admitting the abuse to senior church figures, this clergy person was sent to Rome to work for the church as a translator. Police didn't learn of his crimes until mid-2007, He was charged soon after, returned to Australia where he pleaded guilty and received an 18-month jail term. In another case, a Sydney priest who made a young woman pregnant from an ethnic community was paid to quietly leave the church with his accommodations and university study fully funded. The young woman and her child were sent back to their home country. Doesn't say what the home country was. The special program was established in 1997, funded by the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference to assess and treat male clergy for psychosexual disorders. It was linked to Catholic Church Insurances Limited, which provided secretarial support. The program treated hundreds of clergy from Australia and nearby countries. Church officials from other denominations were also treated, though there were far fewer in number. Clergy were also treated for substance abuse. The reports were made available to senior church leaders and to the church's lawyers. Psychologists associated with the program say the clinical treatment provided was world class and the church's 2008 decision to close it was troubling. It was designed to prevent reoffending, and we'd make recommendations about who posed a risk to children or vulnerable adults. To my knowledge, says one clinician, the Catholic Church is the only institution that did not kick out pedophiles. It tried to help them. Some clinicians asking not to be identified have privately expressed concern over the church's failure to report to police the clergy who admitted abuse or were accused of serious offenses that led to their referral. There's a balance between confidentiality and a duty to warn. The duty to warn overrides confidentiality, said one clinician who saw dozens of clergy in the program. High-ranking Catholics, including Archbishop Philip Wilson, under investigation by police for his handling of complaints about a serial child-abusing priest, were appointed to the board of the special program. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, by the way, the organization that ran the special program was described on its website, now defunct, as an independent company established by the Australian Catholic Church for the good of society. I'll have to check with my lawyer as to whether that's true or not. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. We don't have the music, but we do have a tale of airport security, so maybe you'll just have to hum the lovely music that would be normally accompanying this. Tales, ladies and gentlemen, of airport security, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Dear Harry, this comes from Chris, who loves the show. Thank you, Chris. Dear Harry, I'm preparing for an upcoming business trip, and I'm unsure if it's acceptable to take construction fasteners like nuts and bolts, screws, etc. in my carry-on luggage. So I headed over to the TSA website to see if these were on the prohibited list. They have a little widget on the site that allows you to type in items to see if they're prohibited. So I entered screws. The response, item not found, please check spelling. So I tried nails. Please check spelling. Then bolts. Please check spelling. Realizing this is leading nowhere, I scrolled down to the list to see if fasteners are specifically prohibited. I can't find them anywhere, but the other items section caught my eye. There are four items on the other items list. Gel type candles, prohibited. Non-flammable liquid paint, allowed. Flammable liquid paint, prohibited. And snow globes. The fine print follows the listing of snow globes. Snow globes that appear to contain less than 3.4 ounces, approximately tennis ball size, will be permitted if the entire snow globe, including the base, is able to fit in the same one clear plastic quart-sized resealable bag as the passenger's other liquids such as shampoo, toothpaste, and cosmetics. So, make sure if you're carrying a snow globe aboard a flight this Christmas time, it's a teeny one. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Addy is champing at the bit. He's itching for some news about the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet.
I'm just eager.
Safe, cheap.
First of all, it's cheap. Tokyo Electric Power Company has admitted that the cost of cleaning up after the Fuk disaster and paying off the compensation claims may double to $125 billion.
It's still cheap. It's kind of cheap.
The company released a statement this week that said there is a view that we may need the same amount again of additional money for the decontamination of low-level radiation areas and costs of temporary facilities for storing waste. Don't even mention where that would be. In April, the Japanese government gave TEPCO 1 trillion yen. Do you know how much that is, Eddie?
I do not. Didn't bring my converter with me.
In exchange for a controlling stake in the company, the money was needed to prevent TEPCO from going under. To meet the new figure, the company would need even more support from the government. That worries TEPCO's chairman. If we address the swelling costs by doubling the amount of government bonds, our firm will become an entity only for the purpose of dealing with post-accident issues. It will become difficult for us to raise money from the private sector, so we'll have to rely on the government for the financing of all of our business. Isn't that sad? No more private TEPCO? You have no feeling about this whatsoever.
I take no political stance.
Utility engineers are working to seal cracks at a Fairfield County, South Carolina atomic power plant before the fractures widen and make the plant more vulnerable to a nuclear accident. The South Carolina energy plant doesn't present any current threat to the public, but cracks in the reactor head, that's right, a crackhead at the nuclear plant are a concern that must be addressed, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Without repairs, the small cracks could widen.
That's always true.
And could allow water that keeps the reactor cool to escape. In documents filed with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, SCE&G said plans to make the repairs that will satisfy concerns about the recently discovered flaws. The repairs should be good for at least 40 years. That you can take to the bank, except the bank closed. Well, they can't get investors because of the thing. The repairs have already begun. Nuclear industry watchdogs expressed worries about the long-term safety. Instead of sealing cracks in the aging reactor head, they should install a new head, as some other power plants have done, says one anti-nuclear activist. David Lochbaum, a national expert on nuclear plant safety, said the containment roof eventually could have other cracks. New reactor vessel heads could cost $40 to $50 to $60 million, he estimated.
It's cheap. It's a cheap for a reactor head. Have you priced reactor heads?
No. At some point in the not-too-distant future, it seems like the company will want to replace the head with one that is a little more resistant to this kind of cracking, says Lochbaum. The plant is building two new reactors, first to be built in the United States in 30 years. Hope they have new heads. This is the reactor head is a smaller dome underneath the larger containment dome. The company recently discovered flaws in four welded holes where nuclear fuel rods are inserted to control the chain reaction. The repairs, says company spokeswoman, are preemptive to assure we have no issues in the future. But the spokesperson said the company wouldn't reveal whether it had long-term plans to replace the aging reactor head. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesman said he believes the company will do so eventually.
Eventually you die.
That's right. Entergy Corporation's Fitzpatrick nuclear power plant on Lake Ontario in New York has shut down for the second time in a week. The shutdown last Sunday was triggered by a fire in the plant's main transformer. Nothing to worry about, ladies and gentlemen. The fire broke out 5:45 in the morning, was extinguished almost an hour later. The company said there was no release of radiation and no danger to employees or the public. It was reported as an unusual event. It first shut down. This is in Scriba, New York, when the plant first shut down earlier this month when its turbine stopped during routine testing.
That's a routine thing.
That is. British regulators filed charges against the owners of the Sellafield nuclear waste site this week on allegations of illegal dumping of radioactive waste. This adds to the plant's history of controversy and complaints. The nine charges relate to the dumping of low-level waste in a landfill 2 years ago. This plant has, for the last 60 years, handled Britain's spent nuclear fuel. The regulators charged that the owner of the plant had breached permits by dumping four bags of nuclear waste material at a nearby landfill without authorization. The penalties for such a breach are expected to be small. Earlier this month, operators promised to make improvements after the British National Audit Office said hazardous waste stored in antiquated buildings at the reprocessing plant posed intolerable risks.
Sometimes you can tolerate those.
A 440-page report released by the Department of Energy this week says welds in the inner tank of those Hanford waste storage tanks 40 years ago didn't meet standards and were repaired multiple times. Then in the 1980s, waste was added that likely corroded the bottom of the tank. This is regarding those double-shelled tanks that have been leaking from the interior shell to the exterior shell. Hanford officials say so far they found no nuclear waste leaking from the outer tank into the environment, but notice the use of the words, so far. Clean, cheap, safe. No immediate threat to safety. Our friend, the Atom.
Tell me, tell meant to be. Lord, I need laughing. Lord, I need good, good laughing. Lord, I need laughing. Lord, I need good, good.
From London, England, this is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. A damning report exposing the causes of a surge in insider attacks by Afghan troops has been suppressed by military commanders, according to the Sunday Telegraph. NATO chiefs were warned last year in a document they commissioned that the attacks, the so-called green-on-blue attacks, were part of a growing and systematic threat that was undermining the war effort. But the report from Dr. Jeffrey Borden, an American behavioral scientist, was declared secret. And he was removed from his job and forced to leave Afghanistan. Aside from the last part, it sounds like he's being punished. Since the report was produced, a third of British casualties have been the result of green-on-blue attacks. The report contained a series of warnings about the risk from Afghan forces to their Western allies. It said that attacks were not isolated incidents, as had been suggested by both British and U.S. commanders, but were part of a worsening trend. It added that the attacks were the result of, quote, a crisis of trust, unquote, between Afghan and NATO troops that was not being acknowledged by senior commanders. Days after the report was published in May last year, Dr. Borden's research was roundly criticized by the military, and the document was classified secret. He was removed from his job as a red team leader at the head of a research group formed to find weaknesses in military plans and told to leave Afghanistan, where he'd been working for 4 years. Not even enough time to cancel his subscription to the Afghan Times. Senior officers at the International Security Force described the document's findings as, quote, inconsistent with our assessment, unquote, and said the study was, quote, systematically flawed and suffered from generalizations, narrow sample sets, unprofessional rhetoric, and sensationalism, unquote. By declaring it secret, it could not be shared among officers across Afghanistan. ISAF is American-led. Its deputy commander is always British, meaning it's highly likely that senior British officers saw the report. Dr. Borden strongly criticized the decision to keep it secret. Quote, that was the height of immoral behavior, he says. I have knowledge that can help save American lives, and I was ordered not to give that information out to another military entity. My fear, he says, that if urgent action is not taken in terms of vetting and the recruitment process, we could see this happen with groups of Afghan troops. Almost 18 months after the report was published, senior NATO commanders are now reevaluating its content and putting some of Dr. Borden's suggestions into action. British troops arriving in Helmand province are now specifically briefed that the uniformed Afghan police represent, quote, a significant threat to their security and should not be trusted, unquote. After interviewing more than 600 U.S. and Afghan soldiers, Dr. Borden recognized a rapidly growing, quote, systemic homicide threat, a magnitude of which may be unprecedented between allies in modern military history, unquote. His 70-page report entitled A Crisis of Trust and Cultural Incompatibility spoke of the breakdown in relations between Western soldiers and their Afghan colleagues. Afghans, it found, had been provoked into fights and even attempts to kill by behavior that included Western soldiers, quote, urinating in public, cursing at, insulting, and being rude and vulgar to Afghan fighters, and unnecessarily shooting animals, unquote. Western troops, especially Americans, regarded the Afghans they were fighting alongside as untrustworthy, dishonest, incompetent, and practicing, quote, repulsive hygiene, unquote. Hearts and minds, ladies and gentlemen. Because, you know, why do they hate us? They hate us for our hygiene. Continuing, more news from outside the bubble. And this goes, ladies and gentlemen, to the what we've been hearing so much about for the past week in the United States, which is the kerfuffle involving General Petraeus. The situation down in Tampa. Do you remember the Salahis, the couple in Washington, D.C. that snuck their way into a state dinner at the White House and got their picture taken with President Obama? Well, Miss Kelly, the other woman in the Petraeus kerfuffle, I'm going to continue to call it kerfuffle, and her husband, I don't know if you've been keeping up on this, but they ingratiated themselves into the Tampa Bay community, and they said they were helping the military, helping the troops, by holding champagne-filled valet parking parties for top-ranking generals who are headquartered down at in Tampa at both CENTCOM and the Joint Special Ops Command. A lot of four-star generals down there. A lot of cool parties. Anyway, they like the Salahis, holding a lot of swell parties while being seriously in debt is the basic common denominator. But anyway, all of this has put General Petraeus under the microscope for probably the first time. A lot of journalists who were writing fawning profiles on him in the last 6 or 7 years have now been recanting and saying they feel a little bit taken in. So let me share this with you to help evaluate his contribution in Afghanistan. The U.S. troop surge there ended recently. Conditions in Afghanistan are mostly worse than before it began. That conclusion relies on data recently released by the NATO command in Afghanistan, known as ISAF, and acquired by the Danger Room blog of Wired magazine. According to most of the yardsticks chosen by the military, the surge in Afghanistan fell short of its stated goal, stopping the Taliban's momentum. That's not ISAF's spin. The command notes that enemy attacks this year through August are slightly lower by 5% from that period last year, and that the past 2 Augusts show a reduction in attacks of 30%. But the more relevant comparison is to 2009. Compared to 2009, Afghanistan does not look improved. In August 2009, insurgents used just under 600 homemade bombs on U.S. and allied forces. They used just over 600 homemade bombs on the same forces in August of this year. The same trend holds for every other month in 2009 compared to every month in 2012 for which there is data. While it's too soon to tell if a trend has developed, attacks in eastern Afghanistan, which the surge largely neglected, appear to be down from 2009 levels. So, maybe not the hero we thought. Maybe not the scholar general we thought, but certainly a good emailer. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This, a moment in time from the recent presidential campaign, President Obama on the campaign trail.
You know where I stand. You know what I believe. You know I tell the truth.
And then we have this, also from Wired, which seems to be covering this stuff as if they care. During his confirmation hearing to take command in Kabul, and Afghanistan. Marine General Joseph Dunford told the Senate Armed Services Committee on Thursday, the U.S. needs to present a clear and compelling narrative of commitment to Afghanistan beyond the announced 2014 date that the president had announced was the end of our operations there. Step one, he says, is to negotiate the contours of a post-2014 U.S. force in Afghanistan to, quote, create momentum for that narrative that I was alluding to, unquote. So apparently the Obama administration is saying two things to two different audiences. To the American public, the Obama team talks about, quote, moving with confidence beyond this time of war, unquote, as Obama said during a re-election speech. According to Major General Dunford, quote, it's a question of confidence in the Afghan people that we will remain, confidence in the Afghanistan National Security Forces that we will remain, confidence in the capitals that we will remain, and confidence among regional actors that we will remain, Dunford said. Constructing that narrative is a hedge against the Taliban waiting the U.S. out. Confused? Maybe some help is on the way from our friends at the network.
From CPR Continental Public Radio, the President's Weekly Address. This week, from the usual address, here's the President.
You know, it doesn't seem like almost 2 weeks have gone by since you gave me the honor of being your president again. And already, of course, the criticisms are starting up again. Most recently, when my choice to lead the winding down of our war in Afghanistan told a Senate committee that the war was not exactly winding down. Some commentators suggested that we were telling two different stories to two different audiences. Me having the honor of talking to you, the American people, and the general talking to the Afghan government and its enemies. Well, as someone who promised to be the most transparent president in American history, that's just not good enough. So today, I'll be making the same remarks to both audiences. When I have the honor of talking to the American people, I'll sound like this. And when I'm speaking to our Afghan friends and enemies, that'll sound like this. There should be no doubt in anyone's mind that we have set a deadline for the withdrawal of all American troops from Afghanistan. And that deadline remains the end of 2014. Although calendars around the world can differ, so the definition of when 2014 actually ends is and should be open to negotiations among parties of goodwill. After that date, the Afghan police and armed forces will be on their own, having been trained and equipped by us to handle the challenges of defending their country from a terrorist insurgency that, while having been tremendously weakened, remains dangerously strong. Those forces need reminders from time to time of that training. We'd be foolish not to answer that call, especially in the face of a terrorist insurgency that, while seriously weakened, still controls most of the country after nightfall. We and our NATO partners remain ready to assist the Afghan government in the months and years ahead in its task of healing that country's divisions and building a society that poses no threat to its neighbors, but that can defend itself. Of course, its neighbors will try to take advantage of whatever vacuum we leave, so we have to convince them that it isn't really a vacuum, just a condition of lowered air pressure with morning fog clearing by midday. It's time, as I've said before, to stop nation-building abroad and start nation-building at home. And wherever an American soldier or member of the American intelligence community may be located, that's home, too. I've appreciated the honor of speaking to you once again, and the privilege of once again expanding the boundaries of transparency, because I'm now so transparent, I can see through myself. Have a good week, and thanks for listening.
Funds for this broadcast came from the Nate and Dora Winstanley Foundation for coverage of events we know about in advance. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Cool life, that's what they're selling us. Look sharp, you'll have them a fool. A cool life, that's what they're offering us. Who cares what you think or if you made it through your school? A cool life, your face in magazines. Don't make it look like work. Choose books that may look good on you. And your bespoke shoes.
shoes and your boat tank shirt, don't you know that? Everybody wants parties every night and a shopping jaws. Checking into rehab, that's what all the sexy people do. You know it's true, you'll need your best friends there. And everybody wants a cool life.
A cool life, that's all you read about. There's nothing to compare. I can't be too thin or overpowered. Must learn to live on air. Who cares if Vincent killed himself? If Juliet died in vain? If you wear shades and spray on time? Success will be thy name.
Everybody wants some parties every night in the shopping joints. Checking into rehab, that's what all the sexy people do.
Oh, it's true.
You know, you need your best friends there. And everybody wants cool life.
That's what they want.
Don't you know that? Everybody wants cool life. Cool life. Don't you know that? Everybody wants a cool life.
That's what people do.
Want so cool life. Yes. Everybody wants cool life. Yeah. In your bespoke shoes and your boat tank shirt, don't you know? Everybody wants so cool.
Everybody wants. But.
No shame. In your Jackie O's and your goodness knows what. Let it go, have it cool.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
I am very sorry that we didn't win. That's Mitt Romney talking to hundreds of his donors during that conference call. I know that you expected to win. We expected to win. It was very close, but close doesn't count in this business. He thinks it's a business. The ongoing crisis in the British media has drawn in a new player as the BBC continues to sift through its scandals. In its news division, rival broadcaster ITV is facing scrutiny over one of its own programs. This morning, we'll have to answer whether a recent interview with Prime Minister Cameron breached the broadcasting code by failing to provide a right of reply to a former Tory cabinet member when he was incorrectly linked to child sex abuse allegations. Host Philip Schofield has been forced to apologize after he confronted Cameron with a list of alleged perpetrators he had gleaned, quote, in about 3 minutes on the internet, unquote, and the list was briefly made visible to the cameras. ITV has apologized for its role in that broadcast and claims that Schofield and three production staff are facing appropriate disciplinary action. The BBC, meanwhile, is still apologizing. Now for this. The chief rabbi of London had just completed one of its regular Thought for the Day broadcasts when he was asked by the presenter of the Today program, Evan Davis, if he had any thoughts on the clashes in the Middle East. The leader paused and sighed audibly before suggesting that Iran was the real issue behind the crisis. The co-presenter was clearly concerned that the rabbi did not seem to know his remarks were still being broadcast, and she whispered, "We're live." BBC apologized for catching the chief rabbi off guard. BBC reiterated its apology. In case the iteration itself was not enough, members of the South Bend, Indiana County Election Board apologized to voters who were inconvenienced or worse, disenfranchised Election Day after a handful of precincts in the county ran out of ballots. They're going to move to a new system of voting centers in 2014. The voting machines in the county intends to use of the centers print ballots on demand, making it next to impossible to run out. Quote, as long as we don't run out of paper, says the head of the board. Yeah, that could never happen. After enduring 2 days of criticism, Maine Republican Party Chairman Charlie Webster has apologized for suggesting that groups of unknown black voters showed up at rural polling places on Election Day. It was my intention to talk not about race, but about perceived voting irregularities. However, my comments were made without proof of wrongdoing, and they had the unintended consequences of casting aspersions on an entire group of Americans. For that, he says, I am truly sorry. Dateline Ellicott City, Maryland, the Howard County School Board has apologized for maintaining segregated schools through the mid-1960s. Members read from a proclamation Thursday expressing profound regret for segregation and its treatment of black students. The county today has one of the highest performing school systems in the country. The Interior Secretary Ken Salazar apologized for threatening to punch a Colorado reporter who asked him about problems with the government's wild horse program at a campaign event. A U.S. serviceman who allegedly hit a Japanese schoolboy in the face after drunkenly breaking into his home in Okinawa has apologized. We keep making friends in Okinawa. Cold Stone Creamery is reaching out to potential customers on Twitter 48 hours after their now-fired employee posted an Obama Facebook slur that riled up many people on social media. Florida State football coach Jimbo Fisher apologized Monday for using the term retarded in response to a question about his team's ranking in the bowl championship series standings. And Victoria's Secret has apologized over a Native American-inspired look worn at its annual fashion show and says it will pull the ensemble from the event's upcoming TV broadcast. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. This USAN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.4490 megahertz shortwave. That was the old frequency I lapsed into momentarily there. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And be just like there being no immediate danger to safety, ever, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Adrian Bodnam at Global Radio here in London. He's waving at you, ladies and gentlemen, for helping with today's broadcast. This broadcast is represented on Twitter. Join the more than 77,000 folks at the Harry Shearer. If you're in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, or New Orleans, keep an eye out for Judith Owen and Harry Shearer Christmas sing-along show benefiting charities this year, both in New Orleans and New York, coming next month. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless and the home of the Rubber Promise. So long from London. Brrr.